It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up later, a male birth control pill could be coming sooner than you think. We'll hear about the latest efforts to develop a hormonal method of birth control and what the remaining obstacles are. First, the United States is a country founded in many respects on ideas. But defining big concepts like equality, liberty, self-interest, freedom, and America's place in the world has always been a messy process. That ongoing conversation has given life in many ways to our culture and politics over the last few centuries. It's also the basis for the field of intellectual history, which our next guest says is a way to eavesdrop on the past. Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen is a professor of history at UW-Madison and author of several books. Her latest is The Ideas That Made America a Brief History. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, why tackle the study of history through the lens of ideas?
Spending now my life doing this, I can't imagine any other way of wanting to do it. There are a couple of reasons. One is why most people, I think, are drawn to history is because they're drawn to thinking about how people in the past made sense of themselves, you know, how they made a life for themselves, how they made a world for themselves. And what better way to do that to then, as I say in the book, you know, eavesdrop on how they think about themselves, how they think about their world, how they think about the major problems of the day. So I think it's a way of kind of closing up the distance between us and people in the past and being in a conversation with them.
And speaking of conversation, I hope you don't mind me spoiling the last line of your book. And so the conversation of American thought continues. And that seems like a running theme. It's not just these isolated parade of ideas. It's ideas that cross national boundaries, that cross the boundaries of decades, too. These things keep interacting in new and unexpected ways.
I'm glad you picked up on that last line. The last line of a book is always a hard one, right? Because you want to stick the landing. And it's funny that you pick up on that because the book was provisionally called American Conversations. I think to make the point that American intellectual history, you know, you can talk about it as a tradition, but that makes it sound so formal, so complete, you know, as if it's this artifact that gets handed down from one generation to the next. But that's not how ideas work. That's not how history works. It is an ongoing conversation. People across time, across the expanses, you know, of history, across places, and then, of course, across national boundaries, sometimes linguistic boundaries. And so that is the approach of the book, and I think the approach of intellectual history more broadly is to see how Americans have talked with each other and past each other and sometimes shouted at each other about the things that were most important to them.
And another theme that I think runs through the book is the people who weren't part of the conversation or who were omitted from the conversation sometimes, but were unmistakable parts of it still, from the early interactions of Europeans and Native Americans, from slaves in America, women throughout the history you look at. They weren't not there, but in some ways they were ignored in the main, what we think back on in the main intellectual conversation. Can you talk about the role and the importance of looking at their voices too?
Thank you for noticing that. That was a challenge of the book. It's a challenge of intellectual history in general, because typically intellectual historians look at, you know, sources like books, magazine articles, newspapers, broadsides, sermons. And for much of American history, who got to go on record, of course, were white men, propertied men, which meant that people of different backgrounds, women weren't as easily, you know, traceable on the record. So that is always the challenge of the intellectual historian, is to widen out from those traditional sources to try to listen to the mental, you know, the records of the mental and moral worlds of others. So that was a challenge to do, but they're there. You know, you have people like Judith Sargent Murray, who's an important Revolutionary era thinker, someone like a Frederick Douglass, who was, you know, one of the most important orators of the 19th century. So the records are there. We just have to look for them.
Talking to Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen from UW-Madison. Her new book is The Ideas That Made America a Brief History. I want to take a whirlwind tour. You cover a lot of ground in the book. Let's start with the first contact between Europeans and Native Americans. As you write about it, and I haven't really thought about it this way, just the existence of Native Americans on this continent led to a lot of reflection about who the Europeans were and the European mm-hmm. settlers in America and how they all fit into the world and the history of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something easy to forget, and partly because the lore that we've inherited through our history, but frankly, some of these European settlers had, which was of a vast open continent, an Eden, or in some cases, a place forsaken by God, where there was not strong enough recognition that there was, in fact, a native populations here and in the hundreds of millions. So for the first 100 years, at least, European settlers and explorers are dwarfed by the Native American population here. And so that's an example, Rob, where you ask me, where do you listen? How do you listen for those silences? Even if we are listening into Puritan era sermons and Native Americans are not mentioned, we as historians know they were there. They were there, right there in the same towns, right on the outskirts. And so kind of looking for the presence of what seem like absences are presences throughout. And so this is any look at early American thought, we have to listen in. Sometimes it's articulated and sometimes it's muffled about what it meant to be a displaced person, whether it was from Germany or France or from the British, somewhere in the British Empire, or even Spain or Portugal, to be landed here on this new continent surrounded by enormous a number of people with a different tongue, different ways, different cultures, and to feel that sense of alienation and estrangement that came as a result of that.
Moving ahead to another challenge, with the revolution predicated on ideas of freedom and liberty and self-determination and equality, and then the contradiction of slavery going on, as you write, actually not just out there, but right at the universities where people were thinking about these things and having to come up with the intellectual framework. And that led some people to abolitionism, saying if we want to be consistent, we have to end slavery. Others saying, no, we're not equal. Here's how we justify this inequality.
Yeah. No, thank you for putting it that way. That's very helpful. And I think something that I tried to do in the book, it's not always easy, but that is, I think there's a temptation for Americans when they think about their past to sort of think about it as a split screen. The North is free and the South, is a slave, or, we've got freedom over here and we've got, some sort of bondage or slavery. And actually the two they're not mutually exclusive. They happen in the same spaces. So you mentioned early American universities. That is something I talk about in the book. Every single early American university is founded on dispossessed land, lands that's dispossessed from Native Americans. Every single American university, in one form or another, has slaves who are building the actual buildings, literally the foundations. Harvard University, it used to be one of the bonuses of becoming the president of Harvard. You had your own personal slave there. We've got examples of students bringing their slaves to school with them. And so right there at the sites of learning, where they're learning, in some cases, the great ideas of the Enlightenment, which is freedom, self-rule, self-determination, is happening in the context, on dispossessed lands in the presence of people who are there in bondage. And many, I would even say a vast majority of these folks are not noticing the dissonance, of those two things. So that's something that I try to focus on the book, not look at slavery and freedom as separate, but how do they work together? I'll give you another example. Thomas Jefferson, one of our most important thinkers about freedom. We can't think about American freedom without thinking about Jefferson, who over the course of his lifetime owned 600 people and had 5 children with his slave. These are not, you have to hold it together, that he's writing Paeans to Liberty while he has an army of slaves serving him. It doesn't discount the work. It doesn't delegitimize it. It just complicates it.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue the conversation with UW-Madison history professor Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen about her new book, The Ideas That Made America. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Which ideas or thinkers do you think have had the biggest impact on America, for better or for worse? Have you seen ideas about things like equality, self-interest, or religion change even in the course of your own lifetime? And are there ideas that you're curious to learn more about? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jennifer, reading through your book, one idea that came back to me, and I remember from high school, and I realized almost nothing about it, transcendentalism. This is one of those things that people point to as a key, fundamental American, uniquely American in some ways, school of thought. Mm-hmm. Remind us what that is.
Perhaps it's easy to forget or want to forget because of its unlovely name, transcendentalism. Even the transcendentalists didn't want to be called transcendentalists. So there's a funny, internal dialogue among Ralph Waldo Emerson and Margaret Fuller and others who just thought this was sort of clunky and silly. So the transcendentalists, for those of your listeners who also have a vague recollection from high school, we're typically referring to a group of liberal, very literary intellectuals, mostly around the Boston area in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, where many of them, and I mean, the names are Nathaniel Hawthorne, Henry David Thoreau is considered in this orbit, pardon me, Herman Melville, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously the biggie is Ralph Waldo Emerson. And they're a group of friends, sometimes frenemies. Some of them are liberal Protestant ministers. Other of them are apostates like an Emerson. But they're all committed to a kind of intellectual project and are working on it together. And that is basically, it comes down to a couple of things. First of all, what the transcendentalists share is a sense that that Americans had achieved their political independence from the old world, but not necessarily an intellectual or a cultural independence. And so what we see with Emerson, and we know it's the self-reliance, right, his big idea of self-reliance and others, was the idea of what would it be like to start an intellectual culture, a set of ideas, a kind of literature that was genuinely organic to our democratic project, genuinely organic to this new world, and not something that we're just inheriting, sort of secondhand from Europe. The second part of it is that what makes the transcendentalists is that they understood that democracy is more than just a political organization, or institution. Democracy would have to also reflect the whole human personality, or in their words, the human soul. So what they're committed to through poetry, through writing, through sermons, through utopias like Brook Farm, was the idea of actually cultivating a democratic personality, a democratic soul.
Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Yes, thank you. This is a fascinating topic, something I've been interested in for many years. I ran for political office in 2008, and in my process of running for the Wisconsin State Legislature, I had a dream about Benjamin Franklin. And I know it's going to sound silly, but I've had a number of dreams in my life about my ancestors and stuff. Well, he came to me and he told me that a Barack Obama was going to be the next president and that this was a great moment for our country. And I asked him, I said, oh, really, why? And he said what you just said about the idea that democracy is a reflection of your soul and philosophy and mm-hmm. community and those kinds of philosophical, mystical aspects of society are really a reflection of oneself.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Does his dream version of Ben Franklin match up to the reality?
Oh, my gosh. Well, first of all, I just want to thank you, Jeff. First of all, I want to thank you for your service. And second of all, I hope that all of our representatives are as intellectually curious and engaged as you are and also have a space for imagination or what you're calling your dreams. Because to be honest, I think the most magical moments in American history have come when people's dreams of what America could be outshot the reality. One thing I would say to Jeff is that there is a specific history in American political thought about dreams and dreaming. The American dream as an idea. Martin Luther King, I have a dream. Obama, dreams for my father. There's no other political no other politics that I'm aware of, it's certainly not in the Western world, where the language of dreams and dreaming figure so close into our political discourse. And I think that is precisely as what you're touching on, is the sense that there's something larger. What, you know, living a truly democratic life, building a truly democratic society is something that needs to is created through imagination, but also needs to leave some space for that imagination. So I hope that Franklin comes back to you again. He's a good person to visit.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen about her new book, The Ideas That Made America. I want to come to a more modern era now. We hear a lot in the political world about the rise of what people call identity politics, politics based on, say, race, gender, sexuality, things like that. And it's presented as a new thing. Mm-hmm. But looking back at the 19th century, I wonder, is it really so new?
It's I don't want to say it's old wine in new bottles, but it's just a new term for a long-standing, if you will, debate or concern in American life. And I would say, I mean, you mentioned the founding, even before the founding, mm-hmm. when Europeans arrive in this continent, what do they have in common? Nothing. I mean, you know, there are people from Europe who came from different tongues, different religious groups, different classes.
They might well have killed each other if they're in the wrong
country
in Europe.
Exactly. Absolutely. And so what happens already, you know, right from the outset in this American experiment is people trying to figure out what is the we. You know, what holds us together as Americans when we have different faiths and we have different tongues? And so the idea of difference, diversity, questions of inclusion have been there right from the start. And we've addressed these questions differently. We've allowed, you know, some people in and some people out over time. We've redistricted, if you will, the we. But that question about how do we live as one, you know, where do we find our unum out of our pluribus has been with us throughout American history. And identity politics is important and significant, but it's another term for a longstanding problem and possibility, if you will, in a pluralistic America.
I also want to talk about, and coming back to an idea we talked about earlier, the way ideas flow from one place to another. You give an example, I think it's in your introduction, about some of the things that inspired Martin Luther King. There's the Old Testament, but there's mm-hmm. also Gandhi. Can you talk about the international flow of ideas that might lead to a pivotal thinker like Martin Luther King Jr.?
Well, that's something, you mentioned it's a brief book, so there's a lot of compression. But that is something I wanted to signal to my readers whenever I had the chance mm-hmm. to, which is sometimes we think of ideas as American, but in fact, they have foreign origins or they crisscross across the globe to become what they are. So the backstory of a Martin Luther King, I mean, this isn't to minimize him. He's singular. He's an irrepeatable miracle in many ways. But Martin Luther King is getting many of his ideas from Gandhi. And Gandhi was an avid reader of Henry David Thoreau and Civil Disobedience. And so that's just one example of the kind of curious crossings, you know, both across space, so geographical crossings, as well as across, you know, expanses of human history that make for what we call this American intellectual tradition or American conversation.
Well, when I think about genius or a great thinker, it isn't necessarily someone who, I don't know how you would come up with ideas out of whole cloth, but it's somebody who takes what's out there and maybe reinvents them, reframes them for the current time.
This you are channeling your inner Ralph Waldo Emerson, because this is precisely Emerson's point about the great genius is actually the most creative reader. So Emerson understood. Emerson is someone who was very, you know, interested in, again, not being derivative, not being secondhand, being his own Adam in history, you know, the first man at history, but understanding that there are intellectual influences coming to him. And so genius, I think, as it's expressed itself in America, is often taking something already there in the Bible, from the Constitution, from Benjamin Franklin, and doing something new with it, you know, reworking it for one's own moment, you know, seeing new possibilities in it. I think a great example, if I may just tuck one in here, is the Declaration of the Sentiment of Rights of Women, 1848. It's modeled on the Declaration of Independence, a time when it was considered, you know, that women could not be free and equal in the way that men could. But in 1848, what do you have but a group of women rewriting the Constitution, or sorry, rewriting the Declaration to declare the independence of women?
In our last minute or so, kind of bringing things home, it seems like another reason to study the history of ideas is these ideas, they're the water we're kind of swimming in, and it's worth it to maybe take these things that we just take for granted and look at the time and place they rose in.
You could not have given a better bumper sticker for intellectual history. So, and this is something I try to talk about in the book. And if there's one thing I hope that readers take away, it's the one thing I hope my students take away is this, that every single conversation we have today, every debate, every conflict, intellectual conflict, everything that we agree on is not necessarily a product of necessity, or, you know, this is not all foreordained. It's a product of history. There's no conversation we're having right now that hasn't in some form or another been wrestled through, struggled through, debated through, you know, in the 1950s, in the 1900s, in the 1850s and earlier. And so to me, that's the great, you know, reward of intellectual history, is that as we wrestle with our post-truth moment, you know, our moment about identity politics, our moment about what's, you know, the state of our very fractured democracy, we can bring ourselves into conversation with some great thinkers and great writers and great advocates and activists from the past who have engaged those same problems in their own time. And sometimes they can help us figure some solutions, but sometimes they just keep us company too. You know, there's a sense of you're part of something larger than yourself. Or we are at this moment because we're going through what many of our forefathers and foremothers have gone through in different form.
We'll leave it there. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen, professor of history at UW-Madison. She was with us to talk about her new book, The Ideas That Made America a Brief History. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the latest developments in the effort to develop hormonal birth control for men. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Hmong pilots flew alongside Americans during the Vietnam War, and only half of them survived the conflict. We'll hear some of their stories. First, ever since the birth control pill for women hit the market in the early 1960s, many have wondered if a similar option could ever be created for men. For decades, the solution seemed elusive or even impractical. But there are efforts underway now to develop a safe and effective male contraceptive, and some of those methods have shown some promise in early testing. So how close are we to having a breakthrough in male contraception? Dr. Arthi Thirumalai is an assistant professor of medicine and metabolism, endocrinology, and nutrition at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle, where she's been involved with male contraception research efforts. Dr. Thirumalai, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's been since the 1960s that the birth control pill for women came out. Is there a demand out there? Is there a need for a birth control pill for men now?
That's a great question, Rob. As we all know, women have a variety of options to choose from when it comes to contraception, and a vast majority of them are very effective. And for the largest time, I think we thought that, you know, that is sufficient and we don't need to look any further. But I think the reality is that there are several men out there who welcome options that they could take the power of, you know, taking on the responsibility of contraception for the couple as well. And even men who are not in a relationship would like to feel empowered to be the ones making the decision about whether they are fertile in the moment or not. And I think there's also a large number of couples in which the women are either unable to tolerate contraceptive methods or their use is just not indicated anymore because of medical concerns. And so in those couples, then there aren't really a lot of options they can resort to because there aren't any male options that are out there in the market at this time. And so I think there really always was an unmet need for male methods. And I think men are more willing and interested in this now. And so we're really glad that that's happening.
Talk about some of the science behind an oral contraceptive for men. How would it work?
So the basic thing to understand is that in the male body, the brain releases certain hormones that then signal the testicles to make testosterone and sperm. And if in men we give a synthetic androgen, which is a male hormone, with or without a progestin, which is a second hormone, either in the form of a pill or an injection or a patch or pellets, when we give these exogenously and they take them, it suppresses the production of testosterone in the men's body, and at the same time, it suppresses their sperm production. But because they're getting this synthetic agent, that will bind to all of the parts of the body that testosterone normally was binding to and exert all the effects their endogenous testosterone would have exerted. And so the men should feel completely fine and not feel like they're not having any testosterone in their body, and at the same time would not be making sperm.
Where are products like this now in the testing process?
That's a great question. So, you know, over decades, we've had several different contraceptive regimens that have actually been shown to be very effective at this. And there are a number of efficacy studies where couples have used those regimens as their only method and seen if it prevents pregnancies effectively. And a lot of them are very effective. Unfortunately, none of those actually made it to market. Currently, our group here, we're collaborating with LA Biomed, UCLA, and with the assistance of NICHD at the NIH. We are trying to get a variety of novel agents through the different phases of drug development. And we're looking at all options of use. So we're looking at pills, we're looking at injectables, and we're looking at gels. And the one that's farthest along is a gel formulation. It's a combination of a progestin called nesterone along with testosterone in the form of a gel that men would apply on their shoulders. And then, so that's the drug that is farthest ahead in development. So currently, there's a study underway across 9 different sites and with the aim to recruit over 400 couples where the men would apply this product every day to their shoulders, and they would use it, the couples would use this as their only method for about a 52-week efficacy phase where they're not using any other form of contraception, and we would see how effective the drug is at preventing pregnancy. In terms of the pill, we have 2 very promising agents that are in a slightly earlier phases of development but have shown in 28-day studies that they were very effective at suppressing testosterone production in men while maintaining their normal testosterone-related functions. And the vast majority of men tolerated both of those agents, the pills, completely fine. A 12-month study of one of those pills is currently underway, recruiting men at both in both Seattle and Los Angeles. And then there's an injection that's probably in the earliest phases of these 3 forms, injections of DMAU, which is one of the drugs, which we've just given men a single dose, and we're seeing how the effects are in these men.
Now, with, say, the gel, since that's furthest along, if everything went right in terms of research, and that's, I know, a big if at every stage, about how long might it be before something like this would be on the market for someone to try?
Yeah, so we're hoping that this study will be able to conclude it in the next couple of years here. And then if everything goes well, there will obviously be further phases of development for the drug. But the realistic and hopeful sort of view here would be that preferably in the next 10 years, we will have something on market that men could be able to use.
And I should ask, the birth control pill for women has been famous over the decades for side effects. I understand there have been improvements over the decades that make that less bad, but not non-existent. Is this something that's an issue for male birth control as well?
Yes. I mean, so any medication comes with some side effects, right? But the purpose here would be to minimize that as much as possible, while at the same time not compromising on the effectiveness of the drug. And again, when we're altering people's hormonal environments, we're likely to see some side effects. But the good news is that all of the agents that we are currently trying out have been largely very well tolerated by men, with some mild side effects seen in a small percentage of men. So nothing that has jumped out as concerning for us or that would discourage us from proceeding further in development for these agents.
And I guess part of the research would be what happens after a man stops using this kind of birth control. Do they go back to being able to produce children?
Yes, and this is actually something that has also been looked at very closely over the decades in male contraceptive research. And the majority of men recover their own testosterone production very rapidly after stopping the use of the product. And their sperm recovery is also almost uniformly comes back to normal over time. Now, how long it takes for that to happen depends on the method they're using. Like a gel form would be shorter acting, so the recovery would be faster, and then it would be the pills, and then in the injections a little slower, but vast majority of men return their sperm production to normal somewhere in the 3 to 12 month range period of time, depending on the method of use. And so there shouldn't really be concerns of long-term effects on their fertility or testosterone production.
Well, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date, Dr. Thirumali, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Dr. Aarthi Thirumali, Assistant Professor of Medicine and Metabolism, Endocrinology and Nutrition at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle, where she's been involved with male contraception research efforts. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, is it time to make Puerto Rico the 51st state in the nation? We'll look at a new bill in Congress that's aimed at giving the U.S. territory statehood status as early as this year, but find out why it might be a tough road. First, the role of Hmong pilots in the Vietnam War has not been well known by the general public, but the sacrifices of those who served in support of U.S. troops is now told in their own words in a new book. It's called Fly Until You Die, An Oral History of Hmong Pilots in the Vietnam War. Author Chia Yuyi Vong is a professor in the Department of History at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. She's also Associate Vice Chancellor there for Global Inclusion and Engagement and Director of UWM's Hmong Diaspora Studies Program. Chia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Well, set the stage for us. How did Hmong pilots come to fly on behalf of the American side in the Vietnam War, or as you write, they called it in Asia, the American War?
Absolutely. Well, you know, during the Vietnam War, most of the activities actually took place in Vietnam, but because of the Vietnam and Laos sharing a border, Laos became one of the locations where the United States implemented covert operations. I mean, we did that all over the world, but Laos was one of the biggest operations during the parallel to the Vietnam War. So the air war was, you know, happening in mass volume in Southeast Asia. But so many of the, you know, planes like B-52s and these wonderful fighter jets, they could bomb from really far up in the air. But what the ground troops needed was the close air support. So to make that happen, the United States secretly trained a few dozen Hmong pilots. And it wasn't just Hmong pilots, you know, Lao and Cambodian and Vietnamese pilots trained as well. But for this particular operation, it was called Water Pump. Because Laos was a neutral country, the United States, you know, the U.S. Air Force, working in collaboration with the CIA, would bring these ethnic minority men from Laos to Thailand to train to become these fighter pilots. So that's how we became involved. I say we because, you know, I was a child at the time, and so Hmong men were recruited to, I think the biggest story, people have heard about Hmong soldiers, but most people have never heard about this Hmong people being fighter pilots. So that's what my book is about, tells that story, because it was a, you know, many things were classified until the 1990s. So you began to have the CIA, you know, officials who work with Hmong, U.S. Air Force, and also many American pilots who flew with them in Laos beginning to acknowledge that they actually had worked with these pilots. So that's how it came about, and that's how I, you know, I'm a historian of the Vietnam War, but very few people have written about this. And so that's what my book is about, is to tell the stories of these Hmong men, a few dozen of them that were trained to be fighter pilots, and they had over 50% casualty because they flew very low. They flew these T-28 planes, and these T-20s, the Model A was just a trainer aircraft, but they modified the aircraft to a D model where they could carry a bomb, and they have guns, and that's what happened to many of the Hmong. They provided a very close air support to the ground troops that the United States actually sponsored as well.
Now, you write that initially some of the trainers, the American trainers, were very skeptical. One referred to the Hmong trainees as hillbillies. They didn't think they'd be able to handle flying. Can you talk about that training process and how these Hmong pilots overcame that skepticism from the Americans involved?
Sure. So over the course of their history or our history, the Hmong people, we're ethnic minorities who mostly lived on the what I call the fringes of these societies in the mountainous regions. So most people didn't, have access to education during the French era. You know, a few people went to school. So few people had an education. So the idea or the perception or the characterization of Hmong people has always been they were primitive, they're backwards, they don't know much about technology or modern society. And so when when the CIA officials were thinking about allowing Hmong to fly, there was a tremendous resistance from American military and civilian leaders that, oh, you can't train these, hillbillies, not my term, but their term, mm-hmm. Or primitive people who, some of the stereotypes are that, oh, these are people you're taking off the backs of buffalo one day and putting them on a plane. So there's all these stereotypes about Hmong. And some of the, ethnic Lao leaders didn't think the Hmong could fly, too. So there was a lot of resistance. But because of the nature of the war and because of the nature of the Hmong, or in particular General Wang Pao, who, worked directly with the CIA, he was a, as many people may already know this, he was the Hmong, military officer who was part of the Royal Lao Army. But he also worked directly with the CIA, and so because of that close relationship, he was able to convince the CIA officials to let a few Hmong begin to train, and then the Hmong men did really well. They all were not men who were taken off the back of buffaloes, just to be clear. All of the men who were selected to train as pilots actually had an average of middle school education. So they were sort of, at the time, the elite of Hmong society. They went to school. They were, several have degrees from the National University of Laos or the teacher training school. So there was resistance, and it was really hard because they had to learn English, and because the language in the air is English. So the men had to overcome a lot of barriers in terms of being an ethnic minority group that people felt weren't, suitable to fly these modern planes. But then also to overcome all kinds of ethnic animosity and I think racism as well. They overcame all of that and succeeded in several dozen that completed T-28 training.
We're talking to Chia Yuyi Vong from UW-Milwaukee about her new book. It's called Fly Until You Die, An Oral History of Hmong Pilots in the Vietnam War. And as you mentioned a little while ago, many of these pilots did die, 50% mortality rates you mentioned. One of those pilots who died in the course of duty was Tao Zhang Li. Can you share his story with us?
Sure. It's Tao Zhang Li. He's, one of the T-20 pilots, and, his aircraft crashed, and so he died. And what's really interesting is that many of the pilots, beginning in 1967, they were allowed to go train, but you would have a small cohort that would train, and then they would come back to work. And because of the high casualty, before the next group would finish training, most of the group that came before them had passed away, right? So Tu Xiong was an individual who was killed in action, and very interestingly, he left his wife and children. And when I was interviewing, most of these pilots, when they died, their parents and family suffered greatly. Whereas before they received financial benefits for being pilots, the families lived much better than other Hmong families at the time. But once the pilots died, the funds start coming, and people then have to struggle on their own. So a really beautiful story. As I went around the country to interview the surviving pilots, I actually was trying to interview his younger brother, who is still so, the pain is still very real for him. His younger brother lives in Michigan, and I actually made an appointment to interview him. So I went to visit him and then had an opportunity to talk with his son, who was 10 at the time when Du Xiong was killed. And after I finished interviewing the two of them, his brother, Tu Xiong's brother, said, "Well, my mother is still here. Would you like to talk to her?" Mm. I didn't know that. And I said, "Yes, yes, yes, please, you know, let me talk to her." So very long story short, one of the most heart-wrenching stories of the book is about my interview with her and, you know, just her love for her son and the sacrifices that she's made as a result of, you know, having her son pay the ultimate price, right? So he died, and she raised his children, and they all moved to the United States. But for her, the most difficult part was being a mother, like many other mothers, too, that I didn't get to interview, but I've heard from family members. You know, mothers, you know, she lost her son, and so she talks about how every day, you know, since he passed away nearly, you know, more than 40 years ago, the pain is still real. Every time she hears a plane here in the U.S., she thinks about him. And, you know, any recollection of, you know, the old country just brings the pain back. And so, you know, that was really hard for me to listen to that.
And you also talked to some of the pilots who survived the war and ended up here in the United States. How did they talk about that experience looking back?
Well, a lot of the pilots, as I mentioned, several of them lived in areas with large Hmong populations, so they have been involved in various Hmong veterans initiatives. But for the majority of them, they came to the United States, they found jobs, they rebuilt their lives in Georgia to, you know, North Carolina, to all kinds of places in California, Minnesota, Illinois, Michigan, Massachusetts. And what they did was, a lot of these pilots, again, at the time, it was such a dangerous task, but they were indeed the most wealthy in terms of Hmong society because they received pay from the, you know, the Army as well as the CIA. So they lived good lives for the short time that they, you know, did enjoy that. But when the war ended and they were forced into exile, many of these pilots, in fact, just wanted to forget about that part of their life and just to move on and to rebuild their lives. So for several of them, being asked to think about that experience, in many ways they talk about how healing the process is. It's very painful to remember because they have tried to forget for so many years. But now that they're able to remember and to make sense of that particular time, as well as what happened to themselves, their friends, and all of the Hmong people who became refugees after the war, it was a healing process for them, but at the same time, it brings back a lot of pain and anger as well, because they know now more than they did back then. Back then, they thought the war was about something different. And then once they get to this country, they better understood the larger geopolitical issues. And that brought some anger into some of the pilots who spoke. And war brings out some of the worst in people. So some of them were very critical of not just American, you know, policymakers and military leaders about the decisions they made, but also the internal political dynamics that happened within the Hmong army. So lots of conflicts there. For example, some of the pilots who were injured but not killed, once they're injured, you know, they're no longer useful to the army. And so it's almost as if they're dead. They're not acknowledged anymore. So that's very painful for several of them. And it comes out really clear in the interviews with them and some of the stories I recount in the book.
Chia, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing their stories with us.
Thank you so much.
Chia Yuyi Vang is a professor in the Department of History at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Fly Until You Die, An Oral History of Hmong Pilots in the Vietnam War. Can cats understand human language? No, probably not, according to new research noted in the journal Nature, but they may be able to distinguish particular sounds within human language, according to that research, and associate it with treats or other good stuff, so it can look like they know their own names. Jay Carlisle Larson joins me now. You are a cat. People don't say owner anymore. You're owned by a cat.
I guess I have like a cat roommate that I pay all rent for and all food for. I mean, my cat is, I like to think she's special and that she reacts to her various names that she has.
And yeah, you were saying that earlier. There's not just one name for this cat
she's
somehow.
She's got about 1,000 names, and I did write some of them down just so I could see how many things I called her.
But if I asked you, JC, what's your cat's name?
I would call
me?
Her Kitten.
Kitten.
Kitten. That's that is not her real name,
creative.
Though. I know. I mean, I have nothing but not an extremely creative cat owner. No, but we also call her, like, Meow Butts, Meow Meows, Shmups, stuff like that. Just goofy sounds.
Does she respond to any of those names?
Yeah.
Okay. And so the thing is, when you're saying her name, you might be offering food or other good stuff?
No, I'll just say Kitten and she'll perk up.
But, well, because then there comes the attention.
Yeah, exactly. She knows that she's about to get a lot of love.
All right. Cats, they think they're people. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.